who are not analytically inclined that creativity doesn't count in our economy. We are in big trouble. Tell even the most creative student over and over again, your test scores are inferior, therefore you're inferior, and the result is yet one more economic dropout. Instead, tell a youngster there are many ways to win. Tell him that creativity and even common sense, social skills, and integrity count in the economic arena. If we convey that message, we will have many more people becoming productive citizens. Testing has its place in society, but there should be more testing of the interests that young people have inside of them. Tell them this: if you want to be successful, select a vocation you love. It's amazing how well people do in life when their vocation is one that stimulates dedication and positive emotions. Unfortunately, most people who find a vocation they love were never directed to it by testing or through the academic environment. It's especially important to note that only 14% of the millionaires studied indicated finding the ideal vocation with standardized aptitude test results. Even fewer, 6%, found it through suggestions from their college placement office. An athlete's heart. Are desire, careful selection, and a strong affection for a vocation enough to compensate for lack of high analytical intellect? Some years ago, one of my undergraduate advisees wanted to go to graduate school and earn an MBA. He'd spent his first 2 years in college generating a lot of C's, and then later, as a junior and senior, he started doing B work. He took the GMAT, Graduate Management Aptitude Test, which was a requirement for admission to the school he was applying to. From the look on his face the morning he consulted me, I could tell he was unhappy with his performance. The graduate school of business he was interested in was not an academic powerhouse, with a GMAT of 450 as the lower minimum for acceptance. But my advisee's score was somewhere in the 300s. He thought that a personal interview with some key people at the business school would offset his low score on the GMAT, but he was told, "You are not graduate school material." What do you tell a young student who has just had his dream of attending graduate school shattered? I told him there were many MBA programs. At the time, some night and part-time programs were really interested in building their student bases, and some did not even require the GMAT. My young advisee soon recovered from the hurt of being told that he wasn't graduate school material, and I was not surprised. This fellow was a gifted athlete, and he had demonstrated a great deal of discipline and determination in sports. He applied those same qualities to finding a school that would accept him, and he succeeded. While in the program, he studied day and night. Early in his graduate studies, one of his professors became his mentor. The professor was impressed with his study habits and creativity, so much so that he hired him as his research assistant. He proved to be a very valuable resource for the professor, and he did well in his coursework. The professor, who had a fine reputation as a researcher and had published many papers, encouraged his assistant to pursue a PhD in business. The professor wrote to several of his many contacts in a variety of PhD programs, endorsing his research assistant's application for admission to their programs. He made it clear that the applicant would never score big on the GMAT, but he would work hard and be a major asset to anyone for whom he did research. The student was eventually accepted to a quality PhD program and worked closely with a distinguished professor. During this time, he began writing articles, and to this day he is still publishing papers in top journals. Note that the editorial review boards of these journals never ask for an author's GMAT score. They don't care that this fellow was 25 before he received his undergraduate degree. They look for breakthroughs, new ideas, unique findings. I've followed this remarkable young man's achievements over the years. How is it that today he holds a distinguished chair as a research professor? What happened to so many of the other PhD candidates who were in graduate school at the same time that he was a student? Most are professors today. Most scored big on the GMAT and GRE. But very, very few have achieved what this former advisee has accomplished. I am particularly interested in the rejection he received in his early college years. He was told by his first choice college that he was not of graduate school caliber. Yet there were several years when this fellow outpublished every single one of the faculty members at that college. The acid test in the testing society. What is the relationship between intelligence, as measured by the so-called intelligence and related tests, and success in life? In a landmark article entitled Testing for Competence Rather than for Intelligence, published more than a quarter century ago, Professor David C. McClelland of Harvard challenged the validity of standardized intelligence tests and related aptitude tests. Validity has many definitions, but the acid test of a measure is how well it predicts certain a priori defined behavior. According to McClelland, traditional measures of intelligence do not account for a substantial portion of the variation in achievement and success in life. However, he maintains that intelligence tests and their close relatives, aptitude tests, are highly correlated with grades in school and college. The reason is that these tests are loaded with certain types of questions, problems to be solved, analogies to be made, and readings to be comprehended, the same kind of topics, assignments, and questions given in course assignments and exams. So here is the logic, or lack of it, that fans of intelligence and aptitude tests propose to us. The tests predict performance in school, and performance in school predicts success in life. Sorry, fans of intelligence testing. Most people involved in research on this subject will agree that results on intelligence tests and grades earned in school are significantly correlated. My own surveys of the affluent confirm this. But do the tests predict anything other than performance in an academic environment? So what about grades? How valid are they as predictors? Researchers have in fact had great difficulty demonstrating that grades in school are related to any other behaviors of importance, other than doing well on aptitude tests. But the popular myth continues. It just seems so logical. The A students are supposed to succeed big time. The B students are predicted by definition to do above average in life. And those who receive C's, D's, and F's are predicted to do not as well as their classmates who are on the honor roll and dean's list. What a perfect world it would be if one could predict the variations in success from grades on transcripts. If this were the case, you could say with great certainty to your son or daughter who just graduated with a straight A average, Buffy, Skippy, you will do well for your entire lifetimes, the next 55 years. But what about your other son or daughter who just barely made the minimum grades to graduate? You'll have to tell your child, you will have 55 years of just barely making it. Life is a marathon. How well you do in this race involves much more than grade point averages, and upsets often occur. Standardized testing cannot be substituted for actually running the race. Otherwise, our government could just redistribute our nation's wealth each year. Give it all to those with high IQs. If they're going to end up with it all anyway, why not just speed up the process? Well, how about giving our youth a chance? Let them play life's game. Don't tell them just before it starts. The game's over. You lose. You can never win. You won't succeed with those grades, those SATs. The general public and many psychologists and college officers simply have been unable to believe or accept the fact that high test scores predict only performance in school and don't predict success in other behaviors and outcomes. Why is our society so concerned with testing intelligence? We place great emphasis on achievement, and we want to know even beforehand who will achieve tomorrow in the real world of work. We want to give awards to achievers even before they achieve. We are the a priori, the presumptive society. In spite of this, some students never allow such academically oriented predictions to influence them. A disproportionately large percentage of multimillionaires fit into this category. Those who did well in school and on so-called intelligence tests never assumed for a moment that success was predetermined. What about those multimillionaires who were not A students and who didn't generate high numbers on achievement tests? They never allowed the academic odds makers to dictate their performance in life. They recognized that creativity, hard work, discipline, and certain social skills, including leadership, were more significant than grades and aptitude test results. These are the people who confound their teachers and other fans of aptitude and intelligence testing. It seems so self-evident to educators that those who do well in their classes must go on to do better in life that they systematically have disregarded evidence to the contrary that has been accumulating for some time. This is not to discount the importance of an education in explaining economic success. According to McClellan, a college degree is a credential that opens doors to higher-paying positions. However, he found that students with lower grade point averages in college eventually did as well economically in life as the top students. The results of my research on millionaires are highly congruent with Professor McClellan's. Grades received in college do not explain a statistically significant portion of the variation in wealth or income, nor do SAT results. The only noticeable exception were those respondents who attended medical school or law school. They were required to have superior grades in college and high scores on aptitude tests to be admitted to these professional schools. However, most are not in the decamillionaire category today. Usually they have net worth levels in the $1 million to $5 million range. So who are the decamillionaires in America? They are successful entrepreneurs. Most of these people were not A students. And most were not predicted to become major economic successes based on their test scores. Another problem related to scoring high on SATs and other standardized tests is that sometimes people allow their performance to dictate their choice of study, and ultimately their choice of vocation. For example, take Dr. R.A., the math whiz. She scored very high on the math portion of the SAT, so well that top technical universities expressed great interest in her. She was offered several scholarships if only she would major in computer science, engineering, or mathematics. But Dr. R.A. has more than high SATs and analytical intelligence. She also has a lot of creativity and common sense, and she is a people person. She is very gregarious and has many friends. So what if she scored a 5, top score, on the calculus advanced placement test? Should math and engineering be her only choices? Dr. R.A. wants to be around people and study them. Numbers bore her unless they relate to human behavior. So Dr. R.A. majored in psychology. Her main interest is in psychological measurement. She loves the program she recently completed and loves her career. If Dr. R.A. had listened to the guidance counselor who told her she should major in math, science, or engineering, Dr. R.A. would have been unhappy in those programs. The counselor just looked at her math scores and didn't give any weight to other factors. My data clearly show a strong negative correlation between job satisfaction and those strong mandates about career choice that come from parents and counselors because of test scores. Follow Dr. R.A.'s lead. Have the strength and the resolve to fight for what you want and need. Do not allow others to tell you what is supposed to make you happy. If you have a high level of intelligence, as predicted by IQ test scores, you have great capacity or potential. But if it's not used in ways that fulfill you psychologically, it's not likely that you will become a total success. Total success usually requires that you enjoy your vocation. Professor Steinberg says it best. Nevertheless, between 75% and 96% of the variance in real-world criteria, such as job performance, cannot be accounted for by individual differences in intelligence test scores. As for economic success, the logic is simple. If you perform well in your chosen vocation, you are likely to earn more than others, especially if you are self-employed. If you earn more, you have a great chance of accumulating wealth. This is especially true if you have the common sense to save and invest more than you spend. Investing, public or private? There's a lot of talk about the stock market successes that many investors have enjoyed lately. Is it the stock market that produces most of the first-generation millionaires in America? If you read the business and investing periodicals lately, you'd probably answer yes. But I have a different view about the creation of wealth, based on the data I've collected from millionaires for more than 25 years. Only about 1 in 8 millionaires, 12%, indicated that investing in the equities of public corporations was a very important factor in explaining their economic success. 3 in 10, 30%, rated this factor as important. Does this mean that most millionaires do not invest in stocks? Not at all. They just tend to be more realistic about the stock market than many other investors. They seem to view it as one of many places to invest their money. A significantly higher percentage of millionaires, 35%, rated making wise investments as a very important factor in explaining their economic success, as opposed to the 12% who gave the same rating to investing in the equities of public corporations. Millionaires make wise investments, but not all wise investments are listed on the stock exchanges. Most millionaires will tell you that investing in the stock market is not the only game in town. A significantly larger percentage rate as very important, investing in my own business, 26%, being my own boss, 29%, and willing to take financial risk given the right return, 29%. As expected, most business owners and entrepreneurs are especially sensitive to the importance of investing in their own businesses. 87% of these millionaires rated investing in my own business as either very important, 50%, or important, 37%. In sharp contrast, only 12% of these business owners rate investing in the equities of public corporations as very important, 28% rated it as important. Why so much love for investing in one's own business and so little credit given to the stock market? The typical respondent in this survey had an annual realized income in excess of $600,000. Almost all of this income derives from their main vocation as business owners, corporate executives, attorneys, physicians, and so forth. I often quote a multimillionaire I interviewed years ago who summed it all up by saying, "My source of wealth? My business. Any economically successful man doesn't gamble. I don't gamble. I worked too hard for what we got. Once you do that, you're not about to throw it away." This fellow does not invest in high-risk offerings, and he's realistic about the risks involved in investing in other people's corporations. Most millionaires do invest in quality stocks, but they don't intend to make a fortune by doing so. They don't believe that ups in the stock market, after netting out fees and taxes and downturns, can outpace the returns they get from their own business, or as being a partner in a productive law firm or medical practice. Note that a component of the one's own business domain is living below my means. The self-designated wise investors, risk takers, and those who invest in their own businesses have this in common. They are significantly more likely to live below their means. Although frugality and living below one's means is not a top factor in explaining economic success for the entire population in my survey, the most ardent investors, the financial risk takers, are relatively more frugal than other millionaires surveyed. They know they can invest more if they are frugal and spend less on consumer items. Predictions and seeds, public versus private. Today's self-made millionaires are street smart about money and sensing economic opportunities. If they felt that market predictions could be accurately and consistently made over time, many would go out and sell their businesses, cash in their shares in law practices, and put it all in the stock market. This doesn't happen because most millionaires understand what the stock market is and what it is not. It is not something that an individual investor can control or influence. But most millionaires have a lot of control and influence over their own private businesses, their medical practices, and their law firms. And most have a well-diversified set of assets. Rarely do they place all their eggs in one basket. The stock market is one of the many depositories where millionaires invest some of their dollars. But where did these dollars originate? Stock market zealots will answer that the money was earned in the market and reinvested there. If you look at the thousands of advertisements sponsored by investment companies and mutual funds, you certainly get this impression. Rarely, if ever, do they discuss the fundamental source of the wealth. They talk about the excellent return that investors in stocks and stock mutual funds have received over the years, but they rarely tell you where the wealth came from. What do they exclude? A simple point. You cannot invest in the stock market if you don't earn enough money from your primary vocation to pay for more than your food, clothing, and shelter. Almost all millionaires will tell you that the seed of their wealth is their vocation. Very few are professional stock pitchers. They made their money doing other things. But what about people who have more than a few million dollars? Do DECA millionaires give more credit to their investments in equities of public corporations than those with lower levels of wealth? Not really. In fact, one in three DECA millionaires indicated that investing in equities of public corporations was not an important factor in explaining their economic success. Only about one in five millionaires in the $2 million to $5 million range felt the same way. On average, DECA millionaires have more of their wealth invested in private or closely held stocks than they do in stocks that are traded publicly. The reverse is true for millionaires with net worths less than $10 million. In a similar vein, DECA millionaires are less likely to credit investment advisors as a source of their economic success. Note that the term investment advisors in this context refers to those who sell and provide advice related to publicly traded stock. This is especially true for self-made millionaires. What about those who inherited their wealth? Millionaires who received at least 10% of their wealth from inheritance or gifts have a different view. About one half of the inherited wealth group credited investments in public corporations and investment advisors in accounting for their economic success. But would they have been able to invest if they had no money from inheritance? On the other hand, self-made millionaires are particularly fond of private investments. They know that not all the great executives manage large public corporations. There are many extraordinarily gifted managers within the segment called private business. Attorneys are often offered equity positions in private corporations as partial or full compensation for representing these organizations. Or the principals of a small accounting firm are invited by a client to form a limited partnership. Your own business. If you were able to earn several million dollars a year in your own private business, what would you do with your time and energy? Like most millionaires, you would probably focus your resources where they would generate the greatest return, your own business. But then how would you feel about the stock market, investing in the equities of public corporations? Assume that you are a successful attorney, earning several million dollars per year. Your job is very demanding, with 60 to 80 hour work weeks being very common. But you cannot inventory your services. Each case and each client are different. So even if you earn $3 million last year, unless you work harder next year, you will not earn more. If you cannot inventory your services, you take another approach. You invest your earnings. Some dollars are allocated to stocks, and you hope the current value of your earnings invested this way will at least keep pace with inflation. If you can earn a decent return, that's even better. If your stock portfolio has been cranking out 30% gains in the past few years, you might even think about quitting your job as a highly successful attorney and becoming a full-time investment specialist. There are many reasons why you'll never, ever take this course of action. In your mind, being a full-time investor is not a real business. A real business has clients or customers. Sitting in a room by yourself working at a computer screen will never generate hundreds of loyal clients. It may never make you a more marketable entity in the labor market. And you are well aware that some of the biggest public corporations make the biggest strategic mistakes. You know because you participated in some successful lawsuits that took countless millions from these mistake makers. If you ever made mistakes like that, you'd be bankrupt. You know that your own business is much more productive than most large corporations. Your firm's sales, as well as its revenue per employee, are just two measures of superior productivity. Besides, you realize that the high returns in recent stock market history are an artifact of an inflated growth market. So you decline the market offer to close your law practice and become a day trader. Never try to do another man's job. You control your own destiny when you are a business owner or senior executive or even a self-employed physician or attorney. A multimillionaire summed it up as follows. We feel power and control. We know what we're going to do. We make decisions. It's a sense of power. You become king within reason. I have a small corporation. I go into the bathroom and we hold a board of directors meeting while shaving. Those that don't agree with me can resign. Simple. Very democratic. The acid test for investment gurus. Look at it this way. Only 11% of the millionaires indicated that having excellent investment advisors was a very important factor that accounted for their financial success. In sharp contrast, 35% of the millionaires believe that making wise investments was a very important factor. That is more than three times as many than those who gave credit to advisors. Why so little credit to stock advisors? Although the majority of millionaires have an account with at least one full-service brokerage firm, most make their own investment decisions. Millionaires ignore or at least discount many of the suggestions generated by stockbrokers. In interviews, they tell me that stockbrokers are experts at selling, and if they spend most of their time selling, that leaves little time left to study investment opportunities. As one respondent told me, if the stockbrokers could predict the future, they would never keep on being stockbrokers. They can't predict. They make money selling. But more than just the opinions of millionaires are important here. The acid test is this. Given the same levels of income within the same age group, who accumulates more wealth? Would you guess stockbrokers? After all, they are touted to be investment experts. In a recent survey of affluent people throughout America, 121 stockbrokers completed questionnaires. These respondents reported having annual incomes from the low six figures to well over $1 million. How do they compare with business owners and entrepreneurs, senior corporate executives, attorneys, and physicians who had similar incomes? In my comparison, both income and age were taken into account when making these comparisons. The older participants are expected to have accumulated more wealth. On average, age is a significant correlate of wealth. Income is also a significant correlate of net worth. For this particular data set, the equation that was used to determine the expected net worth for each respondent is as follows. Expected net worth equals age times 0.112 times income. In other words, Mr. Edison, a business owner who is 50 years of age and has a total annual realized household income of $340,000, is expected to have a net worth of $1,904,000. Mr. Smythe, who is 45 years of age with an income of $155,000, is expected to be worth $781,200. What if Mr. Edison actually has a net worth of at least twice the expected value? Then he would be in what I call the balance sheet affluent category, the BA category. If, on the other hand, Mr. Smythe had a net worth of one-half the expected value or less, he would be categorized as income statement affluent, IA. This means that Mr. Smythe has a low level of real wealth given his age and income. Nearly 4 in 5 business owners, 77.7%, had actual net worths that exceeded the expected levels. Only 1 in 3 stockbrokers, 34.4%, had net worths that exceeded expected levels. This means that for every one stockbroker who exceeded the norm, there were 2.3 business owners who exceeded it. It's even more telling to compare these two high-income producing groups in terms of the balance sheet affluent, BA, criterion. BAs are those in the top quarter of wealth builders. That is, they are the best at building net worth compared to their income and age groups. In my survey, respondents who had net worths at least twice the expected level are designated balance sheet affluent, BA. Nearly one-half the business owners, 46.3%, were balance sheet affluent, while only 13.6% of the stockbrokers were in this category. In sharp contrast, 27% of the stockbrokers were found to be in the income statement category. But only about 7% of the business owners were designated as income statement affluent. Finally, consider the ratio of BAs to IAs for the two groups. For every business owner in the IA group, bottom quarter of net worth, there are 6.6 in the BA group, top quarter. In contrast, for every two stockbrokers in the IA group, there is only one in the BA group. Could it be that many of those who aggressively sell stocks and related investments don't follow their own recommendations? If they did, one might expect to find more stockbrokers in the BA group. But stockbrokers made up a disproportionately high percentage of those who have big incomes, yet relatively small levels of wealth. There are some outstanding stockbrokers who are balance sheet affluent types. They are not only wise about investing, they are also wise about how they spend their hard-earned money. A case study of a BA versus an IA. To illustrate my points, consider the following two cases. Both of these respondents are excellent examples of their respective orientations. One I will call Mr. Ward, the BA. The other is a high-income-producing stockbroker, Mr. Rogers. Mr. Ward is a business owner with a net worth in the mid-8-figure range. He owns and manages a very successful recycling business. He lives in a home valued at well over $1 million. He purchased it more than 20 years ago for a bit over $200,000, and there is no outstanding mortgage. How does Mr. Ward account for his economic success? Factors that he rates as being very important include investing in my own business, willing to take financial risk given the right return, and finding a profitable niche. Mr. Ward rates as not important investing in the equities of public corporations and having excellent investment advisors. Mr. Ward thinks that investing in public corporations is a way to inventory his profits from recycling, but he doesn't view the stock market as the seed of his economic success. He has about 30% of his wealth invested in publicly traded stock, and his stock holdings have appreciated. But he feels that the core of his wealth is his private corporation. The stock market is just a place to put profits from that core investment. Mr. Ward doesn't take advice from stockbrokers, not even Mr. Rogers, who purchased a $2 million home near him 3 years ago. Unlike Mr. Ward, he has an outstanding mortgage balance in excess of $1 million, and there are other differences. Mr. Ward has a net worth that is 5 times the expected level given his age and income characteristics, while Mr. Rogers has a net worth that is only 34% of what is expected given his age and income parameters. Yet Mr. Rogers has convinced himself that he is wealthy. In his mind, one factor stands out from all the rest as being very important: having the ability to sell my ideas, products, and the like. At the same time, Mr. Rogers discounts the importance of what he sells in accounting for his economic success. He claims to sell advice as well as stocks. But guess what factors he did not rate as important in explaining his economic success? 1. Investing in the equities of public corporations. 2. Having excellent financial advisors. Could it be that Mr. Rogers believes wealth is a function of selling more than investing? That appears to be the case. Whom would you like to provide you with investment advice and products? You'd be better off searching for an investment advisor who is a solid member of the BA crowd. They tend to practice what they preach. I don't deal with financial advisors, physicians, attorneys, or any other professional who is income statement oriented, and I've had to fire a few of them over the years. Their objective is to maximize their income, often to pay for a high consumption, highly leveraged lifestyle. They normally have substantial debts, and I personally believe that many cannot provide superior service when bankruptcy is a potential threat. Precious treasure remains in a wise man's dwelling, but a foolish man devours it. Discipline or luck? Webster's defines discipline as training that corrects, molds, or perfects the mental faculties or moral character. In turn, one who possesses discipline is marked by perfection of mental faculties and moral character. The moral character relates to integrity, for part of being disciplined means perfecting behaviors in productive and moral ways. Most millionaires are well-disciplined. They set their own high goals and then go on to reach these standards. More often than not, they don't have others telling them what must be done. In fact, one of the hallmarks of discipline is one's ability to become economically successful without being given a roadmap. Millionaires make their own roadmaps, and no one tells them what time to wake up or go to work. Once at work, they determine their own priorities, work schedule, and tasks. The discipline to manage their own lives well makes them different from so many others who could never survive if they didn't have someone telling them when, how, what, why, and where to do things. Millionaires, by definition, are accumulators of wealth. Not so for most people in America. They spend all or most of their income. As a result, nearly 3 in 10 American households have a negative net worth. Most millionaires started at economic ground zero, and fully 60% never received a single dollar of inheritance. Only about 1 in 10 inherited more than 10% of their wealth. Most millionaires did it the traditional way, on their own. Their success was usually due to discipline and had little to do with luck or happenstance. Only 12% of the millionaires surveyed indicated that being lucky was a very important factor in explaining their economic success. Contrast this with the percentage of millionaires who attribute their success to being well-disciplined, 57% rated it very important, and working harder than most people, 47% cited this factor as very important. Countless millionaires have told me they are lucky to live and work in America. And it's lucky that there is enough rain for millionaire farmers to grow millions of dollars worth of crops. Yes, luck does play some role, but most economic success derives from proactive behavior. One of my closest friends once told me that I was lucky to have a book on the New York Times bestseller list. "It's all genetics," he said. I told him that he needed to analyze the relationship between making the 1.5 million symbols required to write the book with my Papermate medium point blue pen and being lucky. Or, as countless self-made millionaires have told me, the harder I work, the luckier I become. Later, we will discuss the role of luck in becoming wealthy. A disciplined person sets his or her sights on a lofty target, then figures out productive ways to reach the target. Disciplined people are not easily sidetracked. They could live in a warehouse filled with top-brand alcoholic beverages and not indulge themselves. They could live in a French bakery and not gain weight. Or they could encounter hundreds of economic opportunities and then select the one or two that are best suited to their strengths and the market's needs. It's particularly interesting to note how most of the millionaire physicians feel about luck. Only 4% felt it was very important in accounting for their economic success, yet 73% indicated that discipline was very important. Most of these people had a desire to become physicians before they even entered high school, had the goal, and never lost sight of it. Besides, what does luck have to do with graduating from medical school? What does luck have to do with successfully running a medical practice? Very little, according to these physicians. It is hard to overemphasize the importance of discipline in accounting for variations in economic success. But let me say that if you lack discipline, the chances of your ever accumulating wealth are very, very small. Yes, you can win the lotto. But in most cases, you have a better chance of contracting leprosy. At a dinner party in Sugar Bush, Vermont, my friend John introduced me to the head radiologist at a major hospital. Later, he told me something interesting about the radiologist. He was once a high school dropout. When I wondered how a high school dropout had become a radiologist, John said he got disciplined by his experience in the Army. He was just 17 when he spent a night in a bomb crater at the Battle of the Bulge. All night long, this fellow thought the very next shell fired would kill him, and all night long he cursed himself for dropping out of high school. He figured that if he'd been better disciplined, he wouldn't be in this near-death situation. That night, he made a promise to himself. "If I get out of here alive, I'll become a doctor someday." The difference in this fellow before and after the night he spent with death all around him was the same except for one factor. He now was committed to becoming disciplined. And he became one of the most disciplined individuals who ever completed medical studies. A person with self-discipline possesses an internal compass, a control and navigational system. Self-discipline means that you make course changes or corrections only when they will be productive in reaching your goals. Kenneth Tuchman, founder of Teletech, defined his own form of discipline in a recent interview in Forbes magazine. "I'm a finisher in a society of starters. I have this vision that is constantly evolving in my head." Even if you are lucky, there are no guarantees. At the age of 30, you hit the lotto for $5 million. But will you still be a millionaire by the time you're 65? It takes more than luck just to keep even. I have asked many people who have been fortunate enough to inherit millions of dollars. Those who have enhanced these fortunes will tell you it ain't luck. At the very least, they hired highly qualified trust or asset managers to help them. But they also did a lot of work in allocating their investable dollars. What is discipline? To one multimillionaire from Nevada, it's all about understanding that leasing a Mercedes doesn't make you rich. The target is to keep thinking net worth. Discipline also means standing by your spouse through thick and thin. It means counting your blessings each day for having that great spouse and related gifts. It's paying homage to your spouse every day, just like a decamillionaire construction contractor from Georgia does, by saying, "My wife is tolerant, rational, self-reliant, even-tempered. I am thankful." It is also finding a source for becoming disciplined when you know you are lacking. I once asked a multimillionaire from Nashville about the sources of his productivity and his strong work ethic. He wrote the word military 7 times. To become wealthy, one must be disciplined in thought and deed, disciplined enough to search for great economic opportunities. School days. How would you define the geniuses who have worked for you? They know more and more about less and less. John Parks, millionaire and C student. If you ask the average American what it takes to become a millionaire, he'd probably cite a number of predictable factors. Inheritance, luck, stock market investments, and so on. Topping his list would be a high IQ, high SAT scores, and grade point average in school, along with attendance at a top college or university. It may be difficult to dislodge this cherished myth from our thinking, but my survey of self-made millionaires disproves it, as you will hear in this program. The statistics demonstrate that a minority of millionaires whom I surveyed achieved high test scores or grades or went to top schools. These factors were probably useful to a small percentage of the millionaires, but most attained their high levels of economic productivity without those assets. Are they intellectually gifted? Somehow the publishing industry discovered that I was writing another book. Its trade journal, Publishers Weekly, reported that Stanley is working on his next book, The Millionaire Mind. He hasn't yet signed a publishing contract for it. This article generated considerable interest. But one caller, a senior editor at a major publishing house, did more than express interest in The Millionaire Mind. He asked if I could give him a short verbal summary of the work, and I did. He was particularly interested in the following. Most of the millionaires I have interviewed do not have a superiority complex. On the contrary, they are more likely to have one or more components of inferiority in their self-image. When I ask the typical self-made millionaire to tell his life story, he says, "I was a C student in college. My college boards or SAT scores were nothing spectacular. I am only worth $10 million. I received a D in psychology. My story is not something you would be interested in reporting. I have a learning or reading disability. I flunked out of Wake Forest. I was held back in sixth grade. I only have a high school equivalency diploma. Not one law school accepted me." What do these self-deprecating millionaires have in common? During their formative years, some authority figure, such as a teacher, parent, guidance counselor, employer, or aptitude testing organization, told them, "You are not intellectually gifted." The editor expressed considerable interest in the work and suggested that I read a book which has been very insightful to my research. In the preface to his book Successful Intelligence, Robert J. Steinberg, again one of the most respected authorities on human intelligence, states, "I'm a full professor with an endowed chair at Yale. I've won many awards, published over 600 articles and books, and been awarded about $10 million in research grants and contracts. I'm a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and am listed in Who's Who in America. Odd, then, that my greatest luck in life may well have been a failure. I bombed IQ tests when I was a kid. Why was that so lucky? Because I learned in elementary school that if I was going to succeed, it wasn't going to be because of my IQ. And just as low scores on tests of inert intelligence don't preclude success, neither do high scores guarantee it." What does Professor Steinberg have in common with most of the millionaires I have studied? They were degraded by someone or something during their formative years and school days. Both responded by outworking and eventually outperforming the so-called intellectually gifted. Steinberg also demonstrated considerable ingenuity by developing measures of various types of intelligence. Professor Steinberg dedicates his book to his fourth grade teacher. Apparently, Mrs. Alexa did not pay much attention to IQ scores. As his mentor, she demanded that he become an A student, and he has been ever since. Professor Steinberg earned a BA degree, summa cum laude, from Yale, and a PhD from Stanford. In the middle of writing this section, I took time out with my daughter, Sarah, to hear him speak at the University of Georgia. The program began at 3:30 p.m. on a lovely spring Friday. Normally, few students or graduate students attend lectures late on Friday afternoons. But this one was different. There was standing room only. No one was disappointed in Professor Steinberg's program. He is not only a fine writer, he is an excellent speaker. He points out that most successful people have great affection for their own selected vocation, as he does. But he is obviously creative as well, because he has published more than 600 articles. Professor Steinberg has enough unique ideas for 10 PhDs to be granted tenure at most colleges. Walking back to the car after the lecture, my daughter and I had a conversation. My advice to Sarah is echoed by the millionaires who responded to my survey. Read Steinberg's Successful Intelligence. Use it as a template for achieving your goals. Remember what he says. If you love your job and the topics you will write about, you're very likely to succeed. But you must work hard and use your creative and analytical intellect. Do you know how he has published more than 600 publications? He wrote 600 articles. Think a lot about your choice of topics. Work hard, do much research, write often. If you do, you will succeed. No matter how gifted you are analytically, you will not become successful unless you publish. And to publish, you must work hard at writing about creative and innovative ideas. People who give advice to young people about careers should all be required to read Steinberg's work. Success has many parents, and no single dimension or component fully explains it, not by a long shot. Young people can succeed if they capitalize on their strengths, and Steinberg has many great ideas about how people can enhance their probabilities of succeeding. His own story is a perfect demonstration of one of the important insights revealed about the millionaire mind in my survey. Most of the millionaires were not considered to be intellectually gifted, as determined by standard test measurements or school grades. The smartest kid in the dumb row. When Mr. James X. Patrick was in the third grade, a memorable thing happened to him. His teacher, Sister Eileen, a.k.a. the Punisher, divided the class of 30 students into three groups. Members of the first group were placed in rows 1 and 2. Sister Eileen designated these students as the smart kids. The second group filled up seats in rows 3 and 4. This group contained the average kids. Rows 5 and 6 were reserved for children the sister referred to as slow or dumb. How did Sister Eileen assign students to these groups? According to Mr. Patrick, she used the following criteria: penmanship, spelling, and turning in completed homework assignments on time. Are these the proper criteria to judge one's intellect? Not according to Mr. Patrick. He says, if her criteria were correct, I must have been the smartest kid in the dumb row. Perhaps he is correct. Today he has a PhD degree with distinction from a top university. He is a multimillionaire who owns and operates 3 businesses. He claims that he still cannot spell, and that no one but his secretary on a good day can read his handwriting. He is, however, diligent about getting his homework assignments completed on schedule. According to Mr. Patrick, teachers in elementary school are insensitive to the criterion called creativity. He asks, can you imagine Sister Eileen's reaction when I suggested adding a new letter onto the alphabet? Mr. Patrick is creative and has founded several innovative businesses during his career. He asks, what if all the potential inventors in America were pre-selected in the third grade by people like Sister Eileen? All those smart kids in row 1 with great spelling skills and fine handwriting would be expected to create tomorrow's great innovations and inventions. Thank goodness that formal pre-selections of this type are rare. But Mr. Patrick wonders about what happened to all his fellow members in the dumb row. Did these people believe that they were dumb? Did they give up early on any idea of achieving success in our economy? Mr. Patrick thinks that many do give up. He feels that his case story is the exceptional one. All my life, people have told me you can't. You don't have the aptitude. The odds are stacked heavily against you succeeding in your own enterprise. Believe Sister Eileen. If I did, I'd be collecting tolls out there on the bridge or driving a truck and paying tolls. Mr. Patrick never believed Sister Eileen's evaluation of him. In fact, even as a young boy, he questioned her authority. He always asked himself while sitting in class, how can penmanship and spelling be so important and the quality of ideas in a paper be totally unimportant? Then in the sixth grade, I remember book reports. All they were really were summaries of other people's ideas. But Sister Eileen and her clan just loved to assign book reports. These people were probably incapable of judging or dealing with original thought. Mr. Patrick is not alone. Most self-made millionaires who are successful business owners had their own experiences with the Sister Eileens of America. Questioning the norm, the status quo, and authority are hallmarks of the thinking of self-made millionaires and those destined to become affluent. Skills in writing, without original ideas, spelling, or penmanship, are not likely to make one rich. But people with these skills are given seats in the smart row. Mr. Patrick was, and still is, criticized and downgraded today. But even as a youngster, he learned to question people who sat in judgment of him. In reality, he became immunized to what fellow dummies took to heart. Others in the dumb row were defeated by Sister Eileen's judgment of their intellect, but not Mr. Patrick. He was inoculated. Sister Eileen's judgments were like small doses of antibodies. When he had a bad evaluation at school, he would go home and build a model airplane or make a new design with his erector set. His parents responded to his finished products by telling him, "You are mechanically inclined, are very creative." And later, in high school and college, it was Mr. Patrick, the D and C student in English and foreign languages, who received A's and B's in his major. He always felt that the A English students had few really novel ideas. Also, in his estimation, they lacked any aptitude in math and science. He constantly told himself that these people would be humbled someday by the harsh realities of the world outside the classroom. In the real world, who succeeds? People who have built up immunity to pain. For Mr. Patrick, his immunization started with Sister Eileen's dumb row designation. What about Mr. Patrick's classmates who were always placed in the smart row? How do they handle a negative employee review or having their jobs eliminated? They've never before had to deal with authority figures who place them in the dumb row. Who is better able to deflect criticisms of their innovative ideas, behavior, and thinking? Mr. Patrick and his type. The ones who have a track record of telling critics to jump in the lake and who are motivated by people who downgrade their innovative thinking. I have to wonder how many thousands of Mr. Patricks were inspired by a recent Wall Street Journal article on this topic, and I would be especially interested in learning how many underlined a key paragraph. Children who are better at mathematics, design, or music than reading and writing may tune out early lessons. Children whose good verbal skills earn them diplomas from prestigious schools sometimes turn into adults who speak beautifully but have nothing to say. What about those who didn't accept Sister Eileen's intellectual segmentation model? Why did they refuse to accept the label of inferiority? Some found an enlightened mentor. Others had parents who encouraged them, motivated them to succeed. Many millionaires have plain old-fashioned tenacity. They think of the Sister Eileens of the world merely as inferior opponents. Mr. Patrick was tickled that he proved his opponent wrong. For several years after he became a multimillionaire, he carried in his wallet a short version of his financial statement. On top were the words, "Smartest kid in the dumb row." What really counts? Tenacity and leadership ability. If our traditional measurements of an individual's potential for success, high test scores and grade point average in school, are not reliable predictors of who has the millionaire mind, what are the factors that count? Millionaires possess two essential attributes, tenacity and leadership ability. Speaking of tenacity, Dave Longaberger recently passed away. His long career as a successful business owner could not have been predicted by some of his grade school teachers. It seems that Mr. Longaberger was held back three times in elementary school. He was 21 before he finally graduated from high school. His poor performance in school was partially due to the fact that he had epilepsy and a significant stuttering problem. It doesn't seem possible that a fellow who was left back 3 times in school could eventually become a multimillionaire. How many of the 7,000 people he employed were left back even once in grade school? How many would want to work for a guy who didn't graduate from high school until he was 21? But realistically, I doubt that any one of the 7,000 cared about class rank. They wanted to work for a man on whom they could depend. Who cares if the fellow paying your salary was not numero uno in school? What qualities and experiences do millionaires who were academic underachievers have in common? Most often, they started working early in their lives. While their self-esteem may have been tarnished at school, it was often enhanced by working part-time. Mr. Longaberger got his first job at the age of 6, working at a store as a stock clerk. But he and most of his fellow self-made millionaires developed and then demonstrated a certain tenacity. One has to be tenacious to overcome stuttering, epilepsy, and being held back repeatedly. He also had parents who motivated and inspired him to overcome his shortcomings. Enlightened parents tell all their children, "You can achieve if you work hard." Hard work is a better predictor of success than grade school experiences. How many of Mr. Longaberger's customers, who last year purchased more than $700 million of his product, were influenced by his performance in grade school? I'll never buy a Chrysler product. Why is it? You say that you just cannot even think of purchasing a motor vehicle made by Chrysler, and you have every justification for your attitude. Perhaps we have little faith in a corporation that allowed an academic underachiever to become its leader. Yes, Robert A. Lutz, former president and vice chairman of Chrysler Corporation, was 22 years of age when he finally graduated from high school. 7 years later, he graduated from college with a bachelor's degree. So forget about it. You don't care that Chrysler makes great products. You only buy cars from companies headed by Phi Beta Kappa members. Many of our millionaires, like Mr. Lutz, are not beaten down by this early lack of academic achievement. Like most, his strength had something to do with his relationship with one or both of his parents. I'll bet he had a kind and supportive father. Perhaps that's why he dedicated his fine book to his dad. Are you like Mr. Lutz's dad? Or would you give up encouraging, mentoring, and supporting your son or daughter if he or she were still in high school at the age of 21? I hope not. Like most millionaires, Mr. Lutz had some great mentors. And the U.S. Marines taught him something about discipline, leadership, and integrity. He later went on and received an MBA. When he was president at Chrysler, many of his subordinates probably had outstanding records in high school and were accepted to many colleges. But these same honor graduates were now working for Mr. Lutz. It's difficult to predict success using academic measures. In the best tradition of the American economy, Mr. Lutz was made president because he was best at that position. He rose over others because he was a leader of people. No matter that those people were considered intellectually gifted or not, they were inspired by a leader. A leader knows how to maximize the productivity of people and other resources, and Lutz proved this ability time and time again. Obviously, Mr. Lutz never believed that his underachievements in high school were precursors of his entire future, or he would never have had the guts to run Chrysler. Nor would he have had the guts to tell his readers that he finally graduated from high school at 22. In any other society, Mr. Lutz might have sealed his fate with his academic performance in high school. But what is considered to be an irreversible trait in China, Japan, England, India, and other countries is reversible in America. We are a nation of comeback kids. Some just take a bit longer to finish the course that will enhance their economic productivity. Early failures, dismal classroom performances, disastrous academic records, and dreadful SATs will defeat those who allow these academic measurements to dishearten their souls. But if one keeps working toward lofty goals, one can and will succeed in America. Luck has nothing to do with it. You are only lucky that you live in America, especially if you plan on being a comeback kid. All A's, all leaders? If we just decide to follow the cultural stereotype, we would automatically assign all senior leadership roles to those who were straight-A students in grades pre-K through 12, were straight-A students in college, scored a perfect 1600 on the SAT. All the rest of us could just go to work for these leaders. But being perfect in school does not translate into becoming a high-performance leader, because analytical intelligence is not a strong correlate of leadership ability. In a well-documented review of extensive research on this relationship, Fred Fiedler and Thomas Link concluded, "Cognitive ability tests have been notoriously poor predictors of leadership performance. Relations between intelligence and leadership and managerial performance account for less than 10% of the variance. Even these low correlations are likely to be overestimates of the true relationship. Leader intelligence under certain conditions correlates negatively with performance." Unfortunately, counselors rarely tell students that 90% of the variation in leadership performance is not explained by standardized intelligence measures. How many kids gave up on themselves early in the game of life because they did poorly in school or ranked low on the SAT totem pole? Perhaps they should be told, "You still have a chance. You may have to work harder, but you may also have the ability to lead other people." It is the hope that they can succeed that motivates people to do so. Take away hope, and what's left is one more economic dropout or a marginally productive person. If you have both leadership qualities and tenacity, you may eventually outpace all the whiz kids in your class. That is exactly what many millionaire respondents have actually accomplished. What millionaires really learned in school and college?